from NPR News in Washington, D.C. This is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. This hour, Marjorie Taylor Greene is resigning from Congress. What are the implications for her party? Then a profile of an Israeli peace activist who has advised France's president to recognize a Palestinian state.
To tell you honestly, I cried because it's something that I've believed in for many, many years, and I see it happening.
And later, the stress many Americans may feel over the rising cost of health care coverage. Also, questions on current operations at the Kennedy Center and Adam Cohen's new book on an ill-fated survival at sea story that raises new questions for today. First, we have our newscast. Today is Saturday, November 22nd, 2025.
For KAXE News, I'm Chelsea Perkins with a special edition of the Up North Report.
Everybody get their own baseline. Get manganese tested on your water.
Tracy, if I can, this is a point I should jump in.
People in the audience of an overflowing Emily City Council chambers last week occasionally interjected and applauded as members heard an update on a potential manganese mining operation. Councilmember Dan Brennan was the one who jumped in at this moment, directing questions to North Star Manganese CEO Rick Sandry. Sandry was at the meeting to share the latest updates on a project that's been on the table for at least 17 years. A third-party study of a possible mine, known as a preliminary economic assessment, shows that not only is it financially viable, but it could make back its investment in less than 2 years. There's a whole heap of steps that the company needs to undertake now. Sandry likened the report to them having graduated kindergarten. There's pre-feasibility reports and feasibility reports and environmental testing, not to mention a likely many years-long permitting process before a mine could open. But what the people of Emily want to know is, when are they going to test the drinking water? And is that water in danger of contamination if an underground mine were to be built? Brennan joined the council in 2024, but he's long been a part of the Emily Mine Information Group, a citizen organization conducting its own research. He says the group took on testing on its own when it became clear that promises weren't being kept by those involved in the exploration before North Star Manganese.
It seems to me that more can be being done to assess the impacts here as well as for you and your bottom line.
Well, that's where the next phase of our activity is to do that. Had we come up with a bad answer on a PEA, we would be telling everybody thank you very much for allowing us to participate up here, pick up our shoes, and go somewhere else to look for another project.
Some of the first exploratory drilling in Emily occurred decades ago in the late 1940s and early 1950s. Various drilling efforts by different mining companies, including in 2023 by North Star, gave insight into what was locked deep below the earth, billions of pounds of rich manganese ore. An accelerated push toward clean energy alternatives and a growing market for electric vehicles and other battery-powered technologies reignited interest in the site's potential. Manganese is one of the metals used in battery production, combined with nickel and cobalt to increase energy storage capacity. While the element is one of the most plentiful on the planet, a small sliver appears to be pure enough for battery use, and signs so far point to Emily's deposit containing that high-quality ore. If the mine moves forward, it would be the only such operation on the continent in a marketplace where most of the mining is happening in Africa and processing in China. The report predicts the mine lifespan would be at least 23 years, producing 400,000 tons of manganese annually. Mayor Tracy Jones asked Sandry to explain in the simplest terms possible what the benefits would be for Emily residents.
You know, 25 years of activity here that people will be buying from the ACE, going to, you know, local restaurants and things of that sort. So that kind of base.
He also pointed to cash payments per ton of material, a plethora of taxes levied by the state that benefit the local governments, and about 100 high-paying mining jobs. 30-year councilmember Gary Hansen, who described himself as among the skeptics, responded.
But Rick, you got to keep in mind, no amount of money replaces what we have here.
This is, and I fully support that.
Sandry said he views this project as his parting legacy in a long career, and it's important to him to get it right.
I'm an environmentalist that's in the mining industry. I believe that things need to be done correctly to be able to utilize the assets that God gave us on this planet. But I believe we should utilize the assets. So I come from that side of the use. And I don't want it to be my reputation or on my tombstone that I caused issues at Emily.
There's more to this story. Find photos and diagrams and more at KAXE.org. That's it for this special edition of the Up North Report from the KAXE News Desk. I'm Chelsea Perkins, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is made possible by Woodland Bank, providing customers with personal and business banking solutions, as well as offering Kasasa checking accounts. You can learn more online at woodland.bank.
Weekend edition from NPR News, I'm Scott Simon. Thank you for being with us. Under President Trump's most outspoken critics in Congress says they're leaving. Marjorie Taylor Greene says she will resign from her seat in the House in the new year. The Georgia Republican was once among the president's fiercest champions, but they fell out over releasing the Epstein files. NPR Stephen Fowler has covered Marjorie Taylor Greene's career. He joins us now from Atlanta. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning.
What seems to have prompted her decision to resign?
Well, Greene put out an 11-minute video late Friday night that details the arc of her nearly 5 years in Congress. She outlined her path as the embodiment of Trump's MAGA movement, touted bills she passed and causes she championed, but mainly there was this pervasive disappointment with the president, her party, the leadership of the House, and the state of American politics.
Americans are used by the political-industrial complex of both political parties, election cycle after election cycle, in order to elect whichever side can convince Americans to hate the other side more. And the results are always the same.
Basically, she says she was elected to govern, and govern is one thing that Congress isn't doing.
Of course, recently, President Trump called Marjorie Taylor Greene a traitor for supporting the release of the Epstein files. Then he signed the bill into law this week. How does the figure of Epstein play into their relationship?
Well, since Trump returned to office, there have actually been a number of policies and positions that have garnered criticism from some Republicans, especially Greene, who said they're not in the spirit of America first. When the U.S. bombed Iran, there was MTG asking how the foreign policy push benefited conservative America first views. She called Israel's war in Gaza a genocide and has criticized America's support of Israel as not being America first. Trump's economic policies, tariffs, importing Argentine beef to try and lower domestic prices. Well, you get the idea. And on the Epstein files front, Trump's campaign promised to release the files related to his life and death and the numerous ways the president stonewalled the release this year before ultimately relenting this week is another factor. Here's what she said in her video.
Standing up for American women who were raped at 14 years old, trafficked and used by rich, powerful men, should not result in me being called a traitor and threatened by the president of the United States, whom I fought for.
Scott, this was basically the last straw.
You mentioned her disappointment with Congress. Republicans, of course, hold a narrow majority there. Did that seem to factor into her decision?
Absolutely. January 5th, the day she'll resign, is right before the House returns to work in 2026. Republicans do have a narrow majority for now, and Greene hints that it's not being used to govern properly and that she doesn't expect that majority to last. There's also a healthy dose of criticism in her statement about Speaker Mike Johnson keeping the House out both before and during the government shutdown and not doing anything like addressing health care subsidies.
The House should have been in session working every day to fix this disaster. But instead, America was force-fed disgusting political drama once again from both sides of the aisle on television every single day.
It is not just Marjorie Taylor Greene that wants to get out of Washington, Scott. She's one of a record 40 House members and 10 senators, mostly Republicans, who have indicated they don't plan to return to their seats after the 2026 election, joining a number of other lawmakers who are retiring or running for a different office.
Does Marjorie Taylor Greene's decision indicate anything, because you cover this beat, about the broader direction of the Republican Party now?
Well, it's not just a one-off fight with a member of Congress. Marjorie Taylor Greene is a canary in the coal mine for the state of the Republican Party. The Republicans suffered defeats up and down the ballot in this month's elections. Economic headwinds are not in their favor. And Greene has put a very visible dent in the previously impenetrable armor that is Trump's control over the GOP and its future. There was always going to be questions about what a post-Trump Republican Party would look like. We're now just seeing that sooner and messier than Republicans would have hoped for.
NPR's Stephen Fowler, thanks so much.
Thank you.
When French President Emmanuel Macron recognized a Palestinian state at the United Nations in September, he revived the discussion of a two-state solution in the West. It was also the result of a lifetime's worth of work by one Israeli-French peace activist. And NPR's Eleanor Beardsley has the story behind this historic move.
Pour la paix entre le peuple israélien.
It was a moment 68-year-old peace activist Ofer Bronstein had been working for his whole life.
Je déclare que la France reconnaît aujourd'hui l'État de Palestine.
To tell you honestly, I cried. Because it's something that I've believed in for many, many years, and I see it happening.
He only regrets the Israelis walked out and didn't hear Macron's message.
The only way for Israel to be secure and for the Palestinian to achieve their goal of freedom, it's to have sovereignty.
I meet Bronstein at the cozy, cluttered Paris apartment he shares with his American wife and aging golden Labrador. The longtime activist was first introduced to Macron in 2019 by a mutual friend. The next year, during a presidential visit to Israel, where Bronstein was serving as the French delegation's Hebrew interpreter, the two men formed a bond. Macron noticed Bronstein's ease and proximity with Palestinians. The Israeli soon became Macron's unofficial peace advisor for the Middle East. Bronstein does not receive a salary. His only condition is a direct line to the president.
I whisper in his ear, usually after 12 o'clock at night, because I know that at night he's more available.
The first mission Macron gave Bronstein was to find ideas that could bring Palestinians and Israelis together. So he assembled a sort of toolbox of suggestions. On top, Arab states should normalize relations with Israel, and Israel must recognize Palestinian sovereignty. The activists pressed for France to lead the way. When the time comes, Macron always told him. It finally did, with Hamas's horrific attack on Israel and Israel's devastation of Gaza.
I strongly believe that if it was a Palestinian state before the 7th of October, if the Palestinians were sovereign to run their life as they want, the 7th of October would have not happened.
Bronstein was born in Israel a few years after the Jewish state's founding to a French-Tunisian father who arrived in British Mandate Palestine on a ship of Holocaust survivors after World War II. His father went on to fight for Israel's independence in 1948. Bronstein calls him his hero.
I miss him a lot, my father. For me, he was a guide, so humble.
Bronstein became an advisor to Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin during the negotiations leading to the 1993 Oslo Accords signed by Rabin and Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. The agreement outlined two states side by side. Bronstein remembers the hope.
It was like an honeymoon. We were sure that it's happening. I was living in Tel Aviv at the time. I was taking my car, and an hour after I was on the beach in Gaza, having dinner with my friends. We were going in and out without any problems. Many of the Palestinians that I met become dear friends of mine.
Then in 1995, Rabin was assassinated. A few years later, the Second Intifada began. Bronstein says he became cynical, But his hope returned, he says, thanks to dear friends on both sides. Bronstein shrugs off the death threats he's gotten for his work with Macron.
What's great about Ofer is that he hasn't lost the fact that he's an activist.
That's John Linden, executive director of the Middle East Peace Alliance, a network of Israeli and Palestinian peace-building NGOs. Linden says it's unusual for somebody who's been at this for so long not to become jaded.
He's brought civil society's voice and impatience. I've seen him be the person in the meeting that is maybe upsetting the diplomats by saying the thing they need to hear. He still maintains his access and his conversations with Macron at midnight, but he speaks truth to power.
Bronstein says the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian West Bank after the 1967 war has been a terrible thing and runs counter to Jewish humanist values.
We occupied 6 million people, and to be able to justify the occupation, we had to dehumanize them. So the Arab is sick, and the Arab is dirty, and this culture is not a culture. And when you have a bad person in front of you, it's okay to kill her. It's okay to put them in jail without trial.
He says Palestinians have done the same thing, painting all Jews as settlers or soldiers.
So it's normal to kill them back.
But the level of violence in the last 2 years is something Bronstein never imagined.
To tell you honestly, I feel ashamed as an Israeli that some people on my name committed this terrible crime. I hope that one day the Palestinians will forgive us for what's happening in Gaza. They will have to decide themselves if they want to ask for forgiveness to the Israeli for the terrible things that the Hamas did on the 7th of October.
The crisis is so deep this time that Bronstein believes there is a real chance to change the status quo.
A lot of Israelis would like to make peace with their friends, and peace you make with enemies. So it's always difficult, and the compromises are always painful.
He believes Hamas will be defeated, but says you can't kill an ideology with violence.
You have to kill ideology by giving people a chance to hope for a better future. You have more than 25,000 orphans in Gaza today. If we won't give him a chance to hope that life can be better, he will become terrorist.
France became the punching bag for recognizing a Palestinian state, says Bronstein. But the deeply prepared French-Saudi initiative laid the groundwork for President Trump's Mideast ceasefire plan.
All of that President Trump understood and he saw. So I'm very happy that we played a positive role in pushing the President of the United States in the right direction.
It's time for Israelis and Palestinians to write a new narrative, he says, much like the Europeans did after the destruction of World War II. A project for the future where they are not just enemies, one that respects the history, the identity, and the pain of the other side. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
And you're listening to NPR News.
Well, I've got two brothers and they're in the Marines.
This is Drew Miller from Boiled in Lead urging you to support KAXE and KBXE. Community radio is a lifeline for culture, and these days it's under threat. If you enjoy it, you need to help pay for it because nobody else is going to do it except for you. Please support KAXE and the Summer Pledge Drive.
Make a donation now by visiting our website, kaxe.org, and clicking the word donate, or text donate to 218-326-1234.
Well, all was a-climbing up that old gallows ladder, cried out so gaily for his highway cap and feather. I've always been a lively lad, never murdered.
You are listening to Weekend Edition here on People Powered KAXE. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Barr. Northern Community Radio's Board of Directors meets at 6 p.m. Monday, November 24th at KAXE in Grand Rapids and on Zoom. It's an open meeting. Members and the general public are invited to attend. For more information, email comments at kaxe.org. Regular meetings of our Board of Directors are the fourth Monday of the month, and the Board's meeting schedule is at kaxe.org. We receive support from Harmony Food Co-op, Bemidji's full-service downtown grocery store, offering people a variety of local, organic, fair trade, and conventional items, open daily from 8 to 8. More at harmonyfoods.coop and on Facebook. The Aiken Fish House Parade is coming up Friday, November 28th at 1 o'clock. There are a variety of events before and after the parade. Find a full schedule at aiken.com/fishhouseparade. There is more ahead from Weekend Edition here on KAXE.
NPR comes from this station and from Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for use in restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping those in need is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. The U.S. Supreme Court weighed in on the Texas redistricting fight last night. Justice Samuel Alito issued an order that keeps in place newly passed voting map that favors Republicans, at least for the moment. The order blocks a lower court ruling that had found that the congressional districts were racially gerrymandered, which is illegal. Several members of Congress don't even know which district they'll be able to run in for next year's midterm elections or not. Among them, Congressman Lloyd Doggett. This summer, the Democrat initially said he would still run in a newly drawn district. Then he changed course and announced his retirement. Then this week, he said he was back in after the lower court ruling. The congressman joins us now. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott.
And now?
Well, what we have is an administrative stay, as you said, issued by Justice Alito, the one justice who's responsible for the circuit in which Texas is located. Excuse me, it's a temporary stay, and this will give the full court an opportunity to review this. And while I would have preferred that he simply urge the parties to get their briefs in without the stay, I don't think it's indicative of the entire court, and I'm still very hopeful given the strong writing of the Trump-appointed Judge Brown in Texas, who wrote the opinion for two judges in Texas reviewing the court, finding it a racial gerrymander, finding it was intentional vote dilution, that holding will stand and that the court will invalidate the Trump map and maintain the Texas map as it existed prior to August.
How difficult is it for you to try and plan a campaign this way, or for that matter, try and plan retirement?
Well, I've always felt the best campaign was good government, and I really haven't changed my activity since the decision came down with redistricting earlier in the year. I'll be out doing events in my district in Austin, the only town I've ever called home, as often as I can in coming days, and then we'll be back here vigorously opposing the Trump agenda in another week when Congress reconvenes.
Congressman Ken Paxton, the Texas Attorney General, said this week that the new Texas maps, and I'm going to quote him now, were simply, quote, responding in kind to years of Democrats gerrymandering. How do you respond to that?
That it's total nonsense coming from a fanatic. The Republicans have already gerrymandered Texas. I'm in my fourth different numbered district as they've tried to eliminate me over the last 20 years, running me one time all the way from Austin to Mexico. That hasn't worked for them. This was an action that they took, as the court found, based on race, following a letter from Trump's Justice Department telling Texas if it didn't redraw four districts that favored African-Americans and Hispanics, that they were going to take action against the state of Texas. The governor added this issue to the call of the special session for action only because of race, and the speaker bragged about their success thereafter. So I think Judge Brown had good standing to declare that they had engaged in racial gerrymandering and intentional vote dilution, and I hope that the Supreme Court will uphold that finding.
Would you, Congressman, having had your own district changed under your feet, what was it, four times, would you like to see politicians get out of the redistricting business, or is that practical? Is it just irresistible for them?
Sure. It probably is irresistible. You're right, Scott. But yes, we need to not have politicians selecting their voters. The voters ought to have to say. This was done on a racial basis, but solely so Trump can maintain total unrestrained control, knowing he has a Republican Congress that is so compliant. California took the right step initially with a citizens nonpartisan redistricting. But that has to apply in all 50 states, not just in those that are currently held by Democrats. We proposed doing that 3 or 4 years ago under Speaker Pelosi. Republicans blocked it. I wish this entire set of events that's unfolding across the country would lead us to true reform so that we would see all voices represented in Congress instead of just trying to build up the extremes.
Congressman Lloyd Doggett, who represents Austin in the U.S. House of Representatives, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks a lot.
Millions of Americans now face higher health insurance costs. That's because open enrollment is happening right now on healthcare.gov. And this year, there is a lot less federal money to help people pay their premiums. NPR's Lena Simmons-Duffin joins us, and we want to caution the story includes mentions of self-harm. Selena, thanks so much for being with us.
Glad to be here, Scott.
What can you tell us about these higher premiums?
Yeah, well, on average, premium costs are doubling this year. And that's because the enhanced premium tax credits that have been in place for the last few years are expiring. Hundreds of people have responded to NPR's call for stories about this. Some told us they have cancer or diabetes. Some are worried about losing access to medications that allow them to work. They're people of all ages and from all corners of the country. Something that shocked me this week that I learned has to do with call centers set up for people to call with questions about enrollment in these marketplaces. I found out there's been an uptick in callers threatening self-harm. Audrey Morse-Gasteyer, who runs Health Connector, the marketplace in Massachusetts, told the board that alarming fact in a public briefing earlier this month.
The duress expressed by people reaching out to us in our call center, to our navigators, is profound. Individuals and families losing the help they depend on to afford to stay covered simply can't believe it.
She said they have a protocol for staff who take calls with people who threaten self-harm. They can potentially engage local law enforcement for wellness checks, for instance. And she said they're making sure staff have the support they need so they can take breaks to decompress afterwards. It's not clear how widespread this problem is. I asked the Federal Department of Health and Human Services if healthcare.gov call center staff were experiencing this, but I did not hear back.
Selena, let me ask you how things go in the political arena. Could these subsidies be extended before the end of the year?
It is not looking likely. The Senate Finance Committee held a hearing this week, and one Republican senator described the party's positions as trench warfare. Republicans in the hearing really hammered the Affordable Care Act as a failure and floated new health reform ideas. Democrats said it's not the time for those debates. People need subsidies extended now. Here's how Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock of Georgia put it.
If the healthcare system itself were a patient in a trauma room, it seems to me that we need to stabilize the system before we can explore innovative treatment options for long-term care.
And Selena, what was the Republican response?
You know, Republicans did not seem particularly moved by that argument. The Republican chair of the committee, Senator Mike Crapo of Idaho, put it this way.
We cannot simply throw good money after bad policy.
He said the enhanced subsidies paper over rising costs and enable fraud. I also spoke to Brian Blaze. He served in President Trump's first term and is now president of the Paragon Health Institute. He was a witness at that hearing. He told me why he doesn't think lawmakers should extend the subsidies even for a year.
They will say the exact same thing next year, that they just need the subsidies to continue.
He fears this will become an annual ritual, and the reforms he believes are critical will never get done.
Selena, could that be politically risky, especially if voters living in Republican areas are affected?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, 3 in 4 enrollees in these plans live in states that President Trump won in the last election. I talked to Anthony Wright of the left-leaning health advocacy group Families USA recently, and he told me that even though Democrats didn't get an extension as part of the deal to end the shutdown,
the understanding about these tax credits is now at a much higher level, and these have always had strong support, but that support only got stronger.
He says voters understand why their premiums are going up and that it's a policy choice Republicans are making. I should say there are some bipartisan plans in the works, but nothing concrete yet, and lawmakers have left town for the Thanksgiving holiday.
And Pierce-Lena Simmons-Duffin, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And if you or someone you know may be considering suicide or is in crisis, please call or text 988 to reach the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. For more than 30 years, Mobutu Sese Soko ruled Zaire, now the Democratic Republic of Congo, with an iron fist. He was a corrupt dictator who lived in luxury while his country sank deeper into poverty until rebels forced him out in 1997. Yet today, as his country struggles with political chaos and conflict, nostalgia for Mobutu may be creeping back, helped by a new exhibit in the National Museum. Emmett Livingstone reports from Kinshasa.
With his thick, black-framed glasses, signature leopard skin hat, and intricately carved ebony cane, Mobutu Sese Seko was the ultimate African strongman. Who else can look after the country if not Mobutu? Who else? Sings Congolese music legend Franco in one of his most famous songs extolling the virtues of the brutal kleptocrat. At the height of his power, Mobutu was courted by royalty and presidents and put Zaire on the map with the legendary Rumble in the Jungle, the 1974 boxing match between Muhammad Ali and George Foreman. Now, nostalgia for Mobutu is stirring again in the Central African country. In Kinshasa's National Museum, the exhibition Mobutu, A Life, A Destiny is drawing visitors and lively comment from across the city. Large photos of Mobutu flanking leaders such as John F. Kennedy and Queen Elizabeth II hang on the walls. Young people, like 18-year-old student Marie-Ange, gaze up at images of the former dictator. Even if he wasn't appreciated by everyone, she says, the country was respected, there was no war, and the environment was clean. It's a view shared by many young Congolese, and a striking sentiment given who the former dictator was.
Élu président du mouvement populaire de la révolution.
That's Mobutu taking the oath of office in 1977 after another election in which he ran unopposed. He had seized power back in the 1960s, and by then, Zaire was firmly under his control as a one-party state. Seeking to forge a new national identity after Belgian colonialism, he changed the country's name to Zaire, built a lavish palace in the Congolese jungle, and flew in luxury items like pink champagne on Concorde. He also built a personality cult. Here, his supporters sing, "Mobutu will remain eternal," even as his power was slipping away in the chaotic final years of his regime. Although Western powers, including the US, backed anti-communist Mobutu during the Cold War, there was no help for him when his regime eventually crumbled. And when rebels reached Kinshasa in 1997, Mobutu, flanked by police, fled to the airport in a limousine and flew into exile, never to return. But what followed were brutal regional wars in which millions of people were killed. Violence that still haunts the east of the country to this day. Now, the Rwandan-backed M23 group controls swathes of the east, running its own government administration. It's a measure of how much has changed in Congo since the 90s that an exhibit extolling Mobutu is taking place at all. It was organized by one of his sons, Nzanga Mobutu, who's the head of a small political party.
Should we let our country be attacked like it is? The women raped, and this is just unbearable. So the question is not whether you're a dictator or not. Can you defend your country?
The exhibit has proved a hit. Boxer Mike Tyson paid a visit when he was in Kinshasa last month, as have numerous Congolese politicians, including President Félix Tshisekedi himself. With many in Congo yearning for stability, some observers say features of Mobutuism are creeping back into politics. In September, Congolese politicians swore oaths of fealty to President Tshisekedi, a ritual straight out of Mobutu's playbook. For some here, it's a sign that the spirit of Mobutu, the so-called leopard of Zaire, still prowls Congo's corridors of power. For NPR News, I'm Emmett Livingstone in Kinshasa.
And you're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Nearly three centuries after his death, Johann Sebastian Bach is still dropping new tracks.
The two new pieces helped me to understand more deeply how Bach's musical language developed in his early years. I learned a lot about this genius.
Peter Volney directs the Bach Archive in Leipzig, Germany. And the quote-unquote new pieces are chaconnes, Baroque-era compositions with melodic variations atop repeated bass lines. Volney has been trying to identify them as Bach's for, well, a long time.
When, as a young graduate student in the early 1990s, I worked at the Royal Library in Brussels, I of course looked at all the Bach manuscripts they had, but I also ordered a number of anonymous pieces, just being curious about what they were. And when I had two manuscripts one day on my desk, the musical language of these two pieces, Bach is the only composer with whom you can connect them in a convincing way. And it took me a long time, more than 30 years.
Manuscripts were undated and unsigned, copied down by somebody else before being filed away. Volney's break came when a 1729 job application surfaced with matching handwriting. It was from a man who'd been one of Bach's pupils in the composer's first job as an organist.
This discovery brought the two manuscripts in the immediate vicinity of J.S. Bach.
Peter Volney says that Bach was about 18 years old at the time.
Bach behaved like an energetic young man. He got involved into fights on the marketplace. It said in the town protocols he took a foreign young woman into the church and had her sing on the organ loft. And in Lutheran Germany, women singing in churches was strictly forbidden at the time.
A rebel in a curly wig. Volney says that spirit also imbued Bach's compositions.
He doesn't simply take over traditional forms and genres according to the standards. He was always trying to do something new, to integrate his new ideas. Experimenting with genres, with forms, with styles, and no other composer is doing that at the time. And when we go later, we see that he's doing this all the time. Always the question of combining different genres.
This week, Bach's chaconnes got their first performance in three centuries at Leipzig St. Thomas Church, where the composer worked and where he is buried.
When we had the two pieces performed on the organ of St. Thomas's Church, everybody was very moved to listen in Bach's own church. It's a great joy of listening to Bach. His music doesn't seem to get old. There are always different angles from which you can approach Bach's music, and it's like walking around a medieval church and looking up the windows, and you always discover something new.
This is NPR News.
Thanks for listening to Weekend Edition here on People Powered KAXE. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 9 o'clock, Stay Human, hosted by Michael Goldberg. This weekend, it's spuds and rutabagas, radishes, and a bouquet of garlic with savvy gardeners and savory cooks. We'll celebrate edible roots and the underground gifts of our folk cultures. That is this morning at 9. You can also catch it tomorrow evening at 5. Coming up at 10 o'clock, Jen Bue, your volunteer host for Back Porch Harmony. Support comes from Grand Rapids Arts, connecting artists and audience, encouraging creativity and collaboration through monthly First Friday art walks and more. Information available at grandrapidsarts.org. There is a Spirit of Unity parade on Monday evening in Hibbing, downtown, starting at 6 o'clock on Howard Street. Let us know what's happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxe.org.
I'm Windsor Johnston with these headlines. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene says she will leave Congress in January. She posted a video last night saying she didn't want her district to face what she called a hurtful and hateful primary. Greene's announcement follows months of public friction with President Trump. The Supreme Court has put a temporary hold on a ruling that struck down a congressional map in Texas. The state keeps the Republican-drawn map in place for now. The justices will soon decide whether it can be used in next year's midterms. Gunmen have attacked a Catholic school in northern Nigeria, kidnapping more than 300 children and a dozen teachers. Security forces have been sent to the area. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From Cigna Healthcare, a health benefits provider that advocates for better health through every stage of life. Learn more at cigna.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Democratic senators are launching an investigation into what they call cronyism and corruption at the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. Senator Sheldon Whitehouse sent a letter with a long list of concerns to the center's president, the former ambassador to Germany, Richard Grenell. NPR's Elizabeth Blair joins us. Elizabeth, thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Scott.
The Kennedy Center is a federal government operation. Senator Whitehouse is on the committee that oversees public buildings. But what prompts these claims?
The announcement on the website for the Senate Subcommittee for Environment and Public Works says that current leadership is responsible for millions in lost revenue, luxury spending, and preferential treatment for Trump allies. The letter from Whitehouse to Grenell had a bunch of concerns. Among them, that non-arts groups are getting discounts on rental fees when they use the Kennedy Center, and that FIFA, the International Soccer Organization, will not be paying about $5 million in rent when it's there for 3 weeks. FIFA will be announcing the World Cup soccer draw from the Kennedy Center on December 5th. He also expressed concerns about lavish spending at hotels and restaurants.
Ever since President Trump took over the Kennedy Center, there have been reports that ticket sales are down, artists, including a production of Hamilton, have canceled shows. Longtime staff have resigned or been laid off, haven't they?
Yeah, all true. The Washington Post recently did an analysis and found that since September, ticket sales are down by 43%.
What does the Kennedy Center say?
Richard Grenell insists that things are just fine, even better under his leadership. He has disparaged previous leadership many times in the past. In a letter responding to Senator Whitehouse, he says the staff was bloated and that the deferred maintenance was so bad that the building was falling apart. He also says that for the first time in decades, the Kennedy Center has a balanced budget. The Kennedy Center's building is maintained by the federal government, though its programming and staff are supported by a combination of private and federal dollars. In his response to Whitehouse, Grenell wrote that he is concerned about your careless attacks on me and my team, and that the senator's letter is filled with partisan attacks and false accusations.
Where does this disagreement go from here?
So Senator Whitehouse is requesting the Kennedy Center supply him with documents and information about the center's financial management practices, expenditures, donors, and contracts under Grenell's leadership by December 4th.
NPR culture correspondent Elizabeth Blair, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And now it's time for sports. The championship of women's soccer, LeBron James, year 23 in the bigs in a town in California, takes after pickleball. Sports reporter Michelle Steele joins us. Michelle, thanks so much for being with us.
Sure, Scott.
National Women's Soccer League Championship tonight. Washington, D.C. Spirit face New York's Gotham FC. They play in the Bay Area. Washington has the star power in forward Trinity Rodman. How do you see the game playing out?
Yeah, Scott, you're a Chicago guy. There's actually a Chicago Bulls connection here. Dennis Rodman, the legend, the Hall of Famer, his daughter, Trinity Rodman, is the superstar in Washington, and they're the favorites in this game. They score a lot, they play real fast, and New York's Gotham FC, meantime, is really the Cinderella here. They're the lowest-ranked team ever to make the final. I think Gotham is definitely going to try to shut down Rodman, but I think Spirit fans should feel pretty good about this one. Her speed should break through, and I see Washington winning in a low-scoring game.
Let me ask about a game tomorrow in the NFL, Cleveland Browns and the Las Vegas Raiders, two of the worst teams in all of organized sports. but the game's getting a lot of attention. Why?
Yes, two words, Shedeur Sanders. That is why plenty of NFL fans are going to be watching an otherwise terrible matchup. If the name sounds familiar, at least the last name, he is the son of NFL legend Deion Sanders. And he's now the starting rookie quarterback for the Browns, and he's making his first professional start. Now, he was the absolute talk of the draft this year because he slid from what some thought would be the first round to the fifth round. The Browns then made him as their fourth string quarterback. But thanks to injuries and classic Browns bad luck, he was thrown into the game, middle of the game last week, did not play well. Tons of hype, tons of pressure around this kid. And that's why this otherwise meaningless game is turned into a little bit of a national audition for the future of the Cleveland Browns, perhaps. I just want to see if he's the real deal or not, or if he's going to be as bad as the team's playing in the game.
An event to mark in basketball Tuesday. LeBron James is going to return from an injury to the Los Angeles Lakers lineup. He will become the only player in NBA history to play in 23 seasons. And he is 40. Turned pro when he was 17, Akron, Ohio high school kid. And he's still performing at a very high level, isn't he?
Oh, yeah. Scott, I was trying to think of real-world analogies to this, right? And I thought, okay, imagine if an actor started their career on a big show when they were a teenager. And now 23 television seasons later, they're not just on the show, they're still the main character, and they're winning awards. You wouldn't know what it's like to be on a show for that long, right, Scott?
No, certainly not. I have no idea what you're talking about. Yeah. Well, I certainly wouldn't know how to do it performing at a very high level. Let's put it that way.
Hey. Well, what LeBron is doing is truly unprecedented. The only player in the history of the NBA to be on the court, step on the court as a player in his 23rd season. And let me tell you this, last season averaged 25 points, 8 rebounds, 8 assists per game.
Yeah.
That's a man in his 40s, folks.
Boy. Finally, Carmel, California, I think they call themselves Carmel by the Sea, or somebody does, is moving to try to ban the playing of pickleball. because people there complain that, you know, ping, plack, 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 ping, ping, pick, that sound is just unnerving.
Mm.
Why are they doing this?
Well, you heard about the NIMBYs, right? Not in my backyard.
Right.
Maybe they don't want pickleball in their backyard. Pickleball, the sport that so many of us love, but many of us who don't play it perhaps love to hate, because it all kind of comes down to the acoustic properties of a wiffle ball. I wish we could get one of your audio engineers to explain this, because they could probably do a better job than I could. But the impact of the paddle on that ball creates a very high-pitched popping sound that is jarring to the ear. It's a noise that cuts through. It's like the beep on a smoke alarm.
Right, yeah.
And the Carmelites, they want to enjoy the beach, the waves, and their charming town.
In peace, thank you very much.
Oh, all right.
Yeah.
Sports reporter Michelle Steele, and peace be with you too, Michelle. Thanks for
being with
us.
Peace and pickleball be with you too, Scott.
Okay. A fascinating and horrifying story now from the South Atlantic. In 1884, a yacht named the Mignonette set sail from Britain, headed to Australia, but sank in a storm off the coast of Africa. The crew of four clambered into a dinghy with barely any supplies, and after 3 weeks adrift, Captain Thomas Dudley reached a fateful decision. Instead of everybody starving to death, they would kill the 17-year-old cabin boy, Richard Parker, who was the sickest of the remaining crew. What happened aboard that lifeboat and the legal consequences that followed are the subject of a new book with this provocative title, Captain's Dinner, A Shipwreck, An Act of Cannibalism, and a Murder Trial That Changed Legal History. Adam Cohen, a journalist and lawyer, joins us from our studios in New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, it's great to be here.
How did you first learn about the case?
Well, it's a crazy story. When I was a first-year law student, my law school roommate and I gave a Halloween party with the theme of come as your favorite case or legal doctrine. And my law school roommate, who I should say is now a federal judge, came as Captain Dudley. And he went to the supermarket. He got some chicken parts, spattered them with ketchup, and wore them around his neck. And I had not actually read this case in my criminal law class. He read it in his. So this was my introduction to the case, was actually my friend dressing as the cannibal.
What were conditions like aboard that dinghy?
They were terrible. There was a leak at first, and the first night there was a shark that was ramming them from underneath that they thought would capsize this tiny dinghy. And then the big problem was that there was really no food and no water, and they were slowly dying of thirst and starving to death. And there was no land. They weren't seeing any ships passing. So they were in quite a spot.
Now, as you write, the custom of the sea, to use that phrase, would be to draw lots to see which crewmate would be sacrificed to help others survive. Why didn't the captain, Thomas Dudley, do that?
He proposed it initially, but he couldn't get his mate or anyone else to go along with that. And then he switched to this idea of let's just kill the cabin boy. I wouldn't give him too much credit, though, for first offering to draw lots, because as I learned in my research, even when they drew lots, it turns out they weren't really doing that fairly. Somehow, no matter, you know, how they drew the lots, it always ended up being the cabin boy or the one enslaved person on the ship or the one black person or the one Spaniard on a ship of British sailors. They always ended up choosing someone at the bottom of the hierarchy to be eaten.
Captain Dudley, I made note of these words, tells the first mate, who has five children and a wife, I have three, meaning children and a wife. Would it not be better that we should kill the boy Parker in order that three lives might be saved?
Yes. He was making a kind of rough utilitarian argument. He was saying, you know, this is the better thing to do. This isn't just murder. This is killing one person to save three lives. This is a good thing, right?
Well, tell us about the utilitarianism that seems to be at the heart of the argument.
So people like Captain Dudley thought, if you can save three lives by killing one person, that is worth doing. And utilitarianism is this idea created by Jeremy Bentham, the philosopher, who said, you know, that which is the greatest good for the greatest number is the moral thing to do. But not everyone agrees with that. And even not everyone in that lifeboat agrees with that. There are other people who say that you don't do wrong things. You don't commit murder. You don't kill an innocent person, even if you can make some argument that it would contribute to the greater good. And in that lifeboat was a man named Brooks who said from the beginning, I do not want to kill. I do not want to be killed. And he would not participate in killing the cabin boy because he just thought it was wrong. So he was the anti-utilitarian person in the lifeboat.
Why were they surprised when they arrived back in the UK that they were going to be prosecuted?
Well, what had changed is the Victorian era reformers had really changed all of England since Queen Victoria took over earlier in the century. They had passed laws that extended the right to vote to the middle class. They had passed laws that protected factory workers, women, children, animals from abuse. They were looking around and trying to make England more modern and better in every way. And eventually by 1884, they looked at the custom of the sea and they said, you know, this thing about you kill the cabin boy and eat him, this no longer feels right to us.
What was their necessity defense argument at trial?
So the necessity defense in law is a defense that says okay, there was a law broken, but I broke the law in order to avoid a greater harm. So an example of that would be if you have a sick baby and you need to get the baby to the hospital and you don't have a car and your neighbor has left his keys in the car, if you take his car to get your baby to the hospital and you're charged with auto theft, you could say, no, no, it was to save the baby's life. That might work. The question in this case was, can you ever plead necessity to murder? Is it ever acceptable to say, I killed this person because it avoided a greater harm?
And why wasn't the court convinced?
The Lord Chief Justice, who ended up handing down the decision, was one of these Victorian reformers. He did not like what went on in this lifeboat. He didn't like it in many ways. He didn't like the fact that it was the people in power choosing the cabin boy. He didn't like, they had something called the cult of the child in the Victorian era. They loved children. That's when like Alice in Wonderland and Oliver Twist were written. They didn't like that the adults were killing the child and the boat. So he didn't like any of it, and he did not believe in the necessity defense. He worried that the devil cited necessity to excuse his sins. So he did not believe that murder was ever justified, and he did not think that this was anything other than murder.
The Queen versus Dudley and Stevens was a landmark case in the UK. Why is it taught in law school today in the US?
Well, fascinatingly, I was able to read some of the cases before 1884 in America where we actually had the necessity defense and even allowed it for murder. There was a case in which a sailor began throwing people off of a boat that was in trouble and had too many people on it. And the judge in that case, who was actually a Supreme Court justice sitting in a trial court by designation, said, yeah, you can do that on the right circumstances. So we had the necessity defense for homicide. After this case, that began to change. And now the majority rule in America is that you can never plead necessity to a murder charge, although there are some jurisdictions that allow it. You know, law scholars would say that it's because of Dudley versus Stevens, even though that's a British case, that changed how America thinks of our law of murder.
And you believe this case raises some very pertinent questions for our future, for example, with self-driving cars.
That's exactly right, because there are many contexts in which we need to make this decision. Is it ever acceptable to sacrifice an innocent person to save more lives? And we need to literally program our AI and program our self-driving cars. Well, what do you program a self-driving car to do if it can save the four lives in the car by swerving and hitting a pedestrian? You know, the utilitarians would say, sure, four versus one, you do it. But other people are saying, and scholars actually are writing about self-driving cars in this way, saying, no, the pedestrian is an innocent. He's uninvolved. He has nothing to do with the car. You don't get to take his life for some calculation that it will save other lives.
So this is a question that's still with us, isn't it?
It will always be with us because we always have to decide about these utilitarian calculations. And we need them sometimes. Obviously, when we're deciding how much money to spend on highway safety, you have to make a calculation. If we spend X number of dollars, it will save Y lives. But the more it's about sacrificing a particular life, you know, of a pedestrian or, say, of a cabin boy, we need to think long and hard. And I do think that the Lord Chief Justice's opinion is a great guide to that and a great reason to push back against this idea that everything can be calculated. And as long as we can make a mathematical argument for why your life should be taken away, we can take it away.
Adam Cohen's new book is Captain's Dinner. Thank you so much for being with us.
It was my pleasure.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
It is coming up on 9 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXC Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXC Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We're people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at KAXC.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up next, Stay Human, hosted by Michael Goldberg, a mix of story and song. 10 o'clock, Back Porch Harmony. Jen Buey, your volunteer host today. At noon, the recorded history of jazz with Paul Kivi. 1 o'clock, Native Lights podcast. That's followed at 1:30 by our new Season Watch podcast. Northern Community Radio's Board of Directors meets 6 p.m. this Monday, November 24th at KAXE in Grand Rapids and on Zoom. It's an open meeting. Members and the general public are invited to attend. For more information, email comments at kaxe.org. Regular meetings of our Board of Directors are held the fourth Monday of the month. Find the full schedule at kaxe.org. The Grand Rapids Centennial Rotary Club has a free Thanksgiving meal Thursday, November 27th from 11 to 1 at St. Joseph Catholic Church. If you would like your meal delivered, place your order by Tuesday by contacting Elder Circle. You can find events up north at our website, kaxe.org. You can see lots of things happening in the upcoming week, lots of holiday kickoff events and things like that. It's time now for Stay Human.